Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today my guest is the amazing, the incredible Rachel Andrew. Rachel is the editor-in-chief of Smashing Magazine, which everyone listening to this podcast knows. She's a member of the CSS Working Group, a Google developer expert, the co-founder of the Perch CMS, and the co-founder of the all-new Notist, N-O-T-I-S-T, website and community, where folks who do public speaking can post slideshows, videos, and more. It's really a hub for your public speaking profile. But wait, there's more. Rachel is also the publisher of the excellent CSS Layout News, which comes out every week with tutorials, news, and information on all things CSS layout. She's also the author or co-author of countless articles and 30 books, including the new CSS layout, Get Ready for CSS Grid Layout, A Pocket Guide to CSS Modules, The Profitable Side Project Handbook, and HTML5 for Web Designers, Second Edition, among others. And some of those books we've had the honor to publish at A Book Apart. Rachel, good morning.
Hello. Hi. It's very early in your time zone. It's kind of lunchtime here, I guess.
Yeah, it's early. But my brother lives in England, so I'm used to that. And so thanks for making the time. And before we get into anything else, let's talk a little bit about time. You do a tremendous – I haven't even gotten into the athletic stuff that you do. Every day you pretty much – jog up a muddy hill or something, and you also fly. You're a pilot. You're becoming a pilot, mm-hmm. right? How do you? And although your daughter is grown up and doesn't live at home anymore, you're a mom. You're a very active family person. So how do you do all this stuff in a given day? Do you have like? Like, what's your trick? Like, do you, for people who want to be more active, but also, do you leave notes for yourself? How does that work?
Organizationally, I'm just pretty organized about things. And I'm also very good at saying no. I do a lot of stuff, but I do the things that I think are most important to do. So I'm quite happy to say no to things. But I am very organized. I follow a kind of getting things done approach to my lists of stuff, which helps keep things on track. But I just kind of have to be busy, and I always have been like that. So if I wasn't busy doing these things, something else would creep in and I'd do that, because I'm not someone who can just sit and watch TV. That's just not me. I relax by doing things, by going for a bike ride or going for a run or, whatever. I'm relaxing by being active, typically.
Tell me more about saying no.
I think it's about understanding that everything that you take on means that you are not doing something else. And sometimes those things that you're not doing are actually more important either to your business or just to you personally. So it's really important when someone comes to you and says, oh, I'd like you to do this, or here's this opportunity, or, can you work on this? It's actually looking at it and saying, well, yeah, that kind of looks fun. And to me, everything looks fun. I could fill 5 days, for every day's worth. So it's like, but it's like saying, well, actually, what am I not going to do if I take this on? What else will I have to push out? Because although I get a lot done, I've still got the same number of hours in the day as everybody else. And so I think it's about prioritizing the things that are most important for whatever reason. That might be the things that are most important to earn money right now, because that's the focus, or the things that are important in your life. If you've got young children, they're going to be the focus, and are you pushing out time with them by saying yes to all the things? So it really comes down to what's a priority for you in your life right now.
Do you have several different, when you start your day, you said the getting things done method, when you start your day, do you go, three things I have to work on today? I have to, for example, I have to do something to increase subscriptions to Notist, or I have to do something, I have to write at least one new article this week. I mean, how do you set goals for yourself?
So yeah, I pretty much have, so you know, everything has its kind of next action. So I know what the next thing I need to do on all of the projects is. And typically I will then, yeah, pick off usually the sort of top three of those. And if I get those done, I'll go on to the next sort of the next thing. But, you know, I prioritize, if someone is waiting for something from me, you know, I don't like the idea of delaying people or for people to be waiting on stuff that I have promised. So I have all my deadlines in there, and I typically, if I've got a deadline, I will set my personal deadline a few days in advance of the real deadline, so that if some life stuff occurs or some other emergency happens, I can still meet their deadline and don't let them down while still coping with stuff that occurs. So that kind of makes me seem a lot more organized. And I always say to people, you know, getting things done on time, shipping things on time and meeting your commitments makes you seem far better at stuff than you really are. You know, just makes you seem very reliable, and people like that.
You're super reliable, and it must be frustrating to deal with humans, right? Because most of us are not. I mean, the thing you just said about setting deadlines ahead of for yourself, a very smart thing, a very great life hack. I don't know many people who do that. I know a lot of people who, if it's due on that Friday, they'll start thinking about it Thursday night. It'd be because they're busy, not because they're bad people, just because the way most people do it. And then if their kid's sick or something, then they go, I'm sorry, I can't do it. My kid just got sick.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's when you have so many commitments and so many people who might be waiting. You know, I mean, I have, you know, Smashing Magazine authors who I'm dealing with. I've got, you know, our own products. I've got, you know, CSS Working Group stuff and things. And so there's a lot of people, and I can't be saying to one person, oh, I didn't do your thing because I was doing somebody else's thing. That wouldn't be fair. Or, you know, I wouldn't feel happy about that. So being very sort of strict to myself in terms of deadlines means that I know that, yeah, if an emergency happens in any of these areas, I've still got time to deal with that and meet the deadline for, you know, the other area. And so that's, I would find it too stressful as a person to not work like that, because I feel very, very bad if I feel I am letting somebody down. I don't like that at all.
Now, in Smashing, as the editor-in-chief, do you have a team of editors you hand things to?
Yeah, I do. We've got some wonderful people who, including my amazing senior editor, Iris, who does a lot of the production work. And they're all great, you know. So we have sort of subject matter editors who are finding people and working with them on the articles. And really what I'm doing is trying to guide the direction of that and figure out which of the things are the most interesting to the membership, which is very, very broad. Smashing has a really broad sort of readership.
Yes.
People are working all over technology. It's not just, you know, web stuff. We have Android stuff, and we have, you know, all kinds of different things. So I need those editors to help me understand what's important in those worlds, because I'm not in all of those worlds myself.
You also have a very broad readership in terms of expertise level. So,
oh, yes, yeah.
So at A List Apart, in contrast, like, I can say most of the people who read us, List Apart, they've been doing it 5, 10, 15 years. They started in the web. Like, I know a lot about most of the people who, that sounds crazy because there's hundreds of thousands of people, but we have sort of a common career track. I feel like the people who work in the editing have a common career track with the people who read it. In Smashing, it's much, it's bigger and more diverse, I think.
I think it is, but then because what we do has become so broad, you know, everyone is a beginner in something. And
yes.
So, you know, if I keep, in fact, I say this a lot to authors, and it's worth knowing, whoever you're thinking of writing for, is that, you know, people often feel they can't write a piece because it's not a sort of new big idea. It's not something special that's never been written about before. But my most popular articles are, you know, sort of introductions to CSS layout. And, you know, we had a really great article on Smashing by Sarah Drasnu, who wrote a sort of introduction for Vue for people who are used to using jQuery.
Right.
Really, really popular. And a lot of people would think, oh, that wasn't a big idea. You know, that wasn't like a really important article. And yet people need that stuff because they're moving from technologies. They might be a professional web developer, but they haven't used Vue yet. And so they want to know about that. So I think, you know, as writers, you know, if people want to get into writing, if just explaining things well for a professional who's coming to that area for the first time, that's really, really useful.
I love that so much. Explaining things well for a professional who's coming to the area for the first time. Yeah. And we're all beginners at this point, like you said, in so many areas. So that kind of the next question I was going to ask you was about how you write an article or two almost every single day, it seems. But I think I've just got an insight in that. One reason you're able to write so prolifically is that you're not necessarily trying to reinvent the wheel. You're thinking, what else do people have trouble with? Do you work with people and they say, I don't understand how such and such works? And you go, oh, I'm going to write an article about that. Is that
absolutely? I have lists of I should cover this, or I should cover this in a different way. You know, I might have written about it, but I'm like, well, maybe I'll do a video of that, or maybe I'll build a really good example of that that people can play around with. Because sometimes writing things in different ways. I do a lot of writing for MDN Web Docs. I, you know, write a lot of their documentation, and that very much is documenting the specs. You know, they're big pieces of writing that actually really dig into, as a bit of documentation, how things work. That's very different from writing about the same subject for Smashing Magazine, you know, where I'll try and make it a bit more friendly and pull out the sort of key bits, and, you know, rather than writing a big, you know, bit of documentation.
Sure.
So it's writing, so I'm often covering exactly the same things, but I'm doing it in different ways for different audiences.
How do you familiarize yourself with the different audiences?
Really, a lot of it is by speaking with it. Because I do so much public speaking, I get different questions from different levels of audiences. If I go speak at a JavaScript conference, for example, I'll get very technical questions about how things work, you know, how it's exposed, how people can actually use it in sort of different ways. Whereas I might speak to another audience and I get questions that are people who are just approaching this for the very first time. They've not used, say, CSS Grid before, and they're asking new questions in the light of having seen, say, some really interesting demos. They might have seen, say, the work that Jen Simmons has done, and think, oh, you know, I'd really like to make some creative things, but how do I do this? Or so it's speaking to different people where they are and finding out what their questions are and treating all those questions as being valid and interesting, because if one person has that question, there are going to be hundreds, thousands of other people with exactly the same question, in my experience. So
right.
It's kind of collecting that stuff, and then, you know, learning how to change the way you write for different audiences. I mean, you know, really, I'm a technical writer. That's, you know, that's just something you sort of learn to do.
It's like what they say about customer service. If one customer says, I don't understand how to do such and such, that means 100 other people also have the same question. They're just embarrassed to ask.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that is very much like or product development, or, you know, you learn to sort of take those things and kind of sort of try and see what the commonalities are and where people are actually confused. And a lot of the work I've done in the last year has been looking into the areas where people are confused about new layout techniques, for example, and saying, well, actually, people don't understand how big things are. So let's talk about sizing. How do we know how big a grid item or a flex item is? Because that's key to understanding how things are going to fit on your page. It's that sort of stuff.
Do you get tired of explaining the same thing over and over? Do you ever feel like, oh my gosh, this again?
I think it's not that I get tired of it. It's that I kind of forget that still needs doing. You know, it comes back to this, oh, I think I need to have a big idea, you know, to write some piece that there's something new. Because you think that everyone knows everything that you've already explained, but of course people are constantly coming along who are new to it. And that's why, you know, you can keep on writing about this stuff, and new people can write about this stuff, because there's always going to be someone else out there who wants to know. So it's not that I get tired about it, it's more that I just forget that it needs to happen, that I can, you know, still do a good article or a good conference talk which covers some of the basics, because some people still need those basics. That they don't, I can't transmit everything that's in my head to them before they listen to the talk, you know?
It's really funny that you mentioned that. You, even your most passionate reader hasn't read everything that you've said or written. And even if someone was like a like the people who used to follow the Grateful Dead or follow Fish or something. And even if somebody was following Rachel Andrew from continent to continent, week after week, as you literally, because I know you do this, you're like all over the place. they wouldn't be able to keep up with everything. I remember when Michael at New Writers asked me to write the Designing with Web Standards book, I said, oh, everybody's heard this. I can't possibly write that book. I'll be just be repeating myself. You know, everybody knows this now. I'm done. This is done. And he said, no, they really don't. And he was right. For a lot of people, the book was when they first heard these ideas. And yet to me, because I was doing, you know, what you do, like just saying the same stuff over and over every day, I thought, well, everybody knows. And they don't.
Yeah. That's easy. It's an easy assumption to make because, you know, you've heard yourself say these things over and over. But also I think that I've found new ways to explain this. I mean, in fact, just for this call, I was in the middle of writing another article for Smashing on Flexbox and doing a little series of Flexbox articles. And I was working on that and I was looking through the box alignment spec and I suddenly kind of came up with a new way to explain something. I was like, oh, actually, that's a sort of a different way to something that I know people struggle with. And all the time I'm refining the way that I'm talking about this stuff and I'm figuring out new things and I'm seeing new ways people are using it. And so I think that actually that process of talking about these things improves the way that you can teach and write about it anyway.
Do you get some of your ideas when you're running or when you're cycling? I mean, when you're not looking at the specs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I find that going for a run or getting out and doing something active is often how I fit. If I'm coding, it's often how I fix bugs that I'm battling with, you know. And quite often it's how I think up, you know, how I'm going to shape a talk or an article or what have you. Or sometimes I get completely new ideas. I tend to run with my phone and say, so I have stopped before and, like, you know, just quickly written some notes like, oh, I'm going to need this. Or I'll come racing in and sit down at my computer. I've not been in the shower or anything. I'm like, no, I've got to write this down quickly.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something about getting out and moving and certainly getting away from staring at a screen and staring at the blank page and sort of wondering how you're going to shape something. It really, really helps.
That's wonderful. We're going to take a quick pause for a sponsor break. So if you want to get a water or something, this would be the time. For you, Rachel, not for listeners. Listeners, sit glued, glued to the headphones because I'm going to tell you something amazing now. Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. That's pretty amazing, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply for your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the very first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. And right now, Big Web Show listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we thank them for making this show possible. And we are back with Rachel Andrew. Our last conversation, Rachel, was episode number 155. CSS Grid Layout is here on March 10th, 2017. That's a year and 5 months ago. A lot has changed since then.
Yes.
Personally, professionally, and on the web. Let's start with the web. What's different in that year and 5 months?
Well, I think certainly in terms of grid, it was kind of funny because I've been talking about grid layout for about 5 years before it shipped. And so I felt like I knew everything about the spec, really, and I was used to explaining it and things. And then suddenly everyone realized that, hey, this is a thing, and it's a thing in all these browsers. It's not going to drip out over the course of the next 10 years. And so really, I mean, I think, you know, I say on stage at an event apart that my inbox just kind of exploded with people asking questions about Grid, and also questions that we'd never really seen before during the process of working on the spec, because people were actually trying to use it in production and coming up with all sorts of things. So that was really interesting, and it's been fascinating to see people start to use it. It's been fascinating to see other people teach it, and it not just be myself and Jen. That's been really interesting, which bits people have sort of latched onto and found most interesting. And then, I mean, obviously, we've been at the CSS Working Group, we've been working on the subgrid sort of spec, which will allow us to have things that are not direct children of the grid container sort of participate in that overall layout, which is pretty exciting. And I think the big thing that's sort of missing from the spec. And that has is really almost at a point of going to candidate recommendation status. So hopefully we'll start to see implementations in browsers of Subgrid really soon. So that's quite exciting. The fact that the spec has, you know, it's only just over a year really that we got it in browsers, and already we've got this level two, and hopefully we'll start seeing that implemented. So there's a lot of momentum, and there's a lot of momentum across CSS, which is really exciting.
This is really fast.
Yes.
The only thing I can compare it to is responsive web design, which is not a spec, but the same thing where there was probably, with responsive too, there was always this, what should we do, what should we do, what should we do about, you know, there was always this sort of undercurrent of people who wanted liquid design versus people who wanted fixed width, and people making bargains like, well, let's say that everyone has 800 by 600 and all that. And then one day, one person, Ethan, coins this phrase, explains this, and within a year, everyone's doing it. Within months, everyone I knew was doing it, right? Within a month, within weeks, there were new websites coming out. And this is the other super fast change that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, in general, CSS is speeding up, you know, because
it's modularized. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that, but there's also the fact that the landscape's changed. We've got browsers which are evergreen now, so browsers are shipping. I mean, you know, the next version of Chrome has a whole ton of new CSS features implemented in it. The next version of Firefox is going to have shapes. It's like, you know, the browsers are just bringing out all this new stuff all the time. And so we're getting things into our hands an awful lot faster, which I think is really important.
You work very closely with a lot of these people who make the stuff we use. Are engineers from, let's say, Chrome and Firefox collaborating, talking with each other, saying, yeah, we're going to ship this, are you going to ship this? Or is it more everyone's working with the W3C and that's how it's happening?
I think there's a bit of everything. I mean, people do work together. You know, on the CSS working group, there are representatives, you know, it's mostly representatives from browser vendors. So they're all working together. And interop, you know, things working, not necessarily having everything implemented in all browsers all of the time, but it's when things are implemented that they are implemented in the same way. That is something that everybody cares about an awful lot. And so quite often when the decisions we made about, well, should we do something one way or should we do it another? If there's already implementations, that's going to guide that too, because it's really important that browsers do things in the same way, and we know that from history. So in general, everyone's talking to each other and making interop the focus. When things actually get into browsers is a bit of a balancing act, because obviously there are big features like Grid that it was really sort of important that kind of happened across the board so that people could safely use it. Other things, it's kind of a business decision. You know, these browsers are just businesses like anyone else's business, and the browser is their product. And so they have to decide which features to put into that product. And so that's going to be different depending on the browser, you know, the focus they've got, you know, what they think is the most important thing for their users. And some of that's going to be, oh, well, we need to match the other browsers because we don't want to be left behind because people are asking for this thing. And that's why it's really important for web developers to actually talk about the stuff they want to see in browsers. and to write about it and to use it, because all of the browser vendors are looking at what we're using on the web and saying, well, oh, a lot of people are using CSS shapes, so we're going to need to have shapes in our browser, because otherwise our browser looks lacking in comparison to everybody else's. So it's really important to use this stuff and talk about it. It really is.
In a weird way, so at the very beginning of web design history, browser makers were looking at what people were doing. And then we sort of got away from that for a while. I think HTML5 was the first really big, we're going to base all this stuff on what developers are doing. Instead of, we have this pure idea of what it's supposed to be, and browsers should rigorously implement that. It became, you know, a lot of developers seem to need this thing, this type of container, and a lot of them call it this in their CSS class name. So let's make that, right? Let's make a footer, because a lot of people seem to have one, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the most exciting and interesting when the people who are making the standard and the people who are implementing it in the browser and the people who are using it are all talking to each other. Right.
Yeah,
that's another thing that you've fought for as long as I've known you. I can remember you, 10 years ago saying, please give us your feedback, or if let the browser maker know, let people know how you want to use this. Let people know that 5 years ago with Grid, let people know you want this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've always thought it's really important. I mean, I'm an advanced expert at the CSS Working Group. I'm not from a browser vendor. And I really see the whole point of me being there. I'm not a browser engineer or someone who really has a background in that. So I see the point of me being there is to try and channel some of the feedback from web developers, from people I meet at conferences or who email me or who I talk to online, to try and channel some of that back into the CSS Working Group. And then also explain the things that are discussed in the CSS Working Group in a way that someone who has not got their head in a spec all day, every day, can understand, because I'm reasonably good at explaining technical stuff in straightforward language. So that's kind of what I try and do, is be that route for information to get out of the CSS Working Group to developers, and then for information to get into the CSS Working Group from what people are talking about.
Taking a step back, people look at all that you've achieved, and I think Jeremy Keith says this thing where the technology that exists before we were born is just what is, and the technology that was invented during our lifetime is cool and we understand it and, all that. I think you just seem like you've been there forever, like Mozart, right? Or the Constitution of the United States. You've just been there. But that's not true. You had to invent yourself. How, for people who are nervous about writing or nervous about public speaking especially, how did you become a public speaker, and what challenges did you face getting over, personal shyness or whatever to do what you do?
Yeah, well, I'm very much an introvert, really, and so you sort of don't map that to being someone who wants to do public speaking. And for a long time, I was terrified of doing it, and I wouldn't do it at all. In fact, Drew and I used to run workshops, and I would write the workshop, but Drew would present it, because I felt that I couldn't present. I could, I could write this stuff, but I couldn't present it. And I'm pretty sure there are some terrible videos out there somewhere of my initial attempt at doing any public speaking, where I looked like I really wanted to die. So it turns out it's a skill you can learn, and I realized that, I've always written about this stuff. I got into doing this by writing, because I was writing down what I was doing, what I was learning, and I was sharing it. And at some point I thought, no, it's really important to get out there and talk to people, because then it opens a conversation and I can hear what people think, as well as just sort of putting this stuff out there. And so I really wanted to do it. And it essentially was, I just had to make myself do it. And it was terrible the first few times. They weren't good talks. I felt awful. But I kept on doing it, and sort of made myself work through that fear and work through just the not being good at it. So it looks at it and said, well, what am I doing that's not good here? Well, how can I improve that? And I don't think I'm the greatest public speaker, but I am now reasonably good at taking the technical things I know and presenting them to an audience in a clear way. I'm not going to be the entertainment slot, and I'm okay with that. You know, I have a thing that I do, and I think I do that pretty well, and I still keep working on it. And you don't have to be this sort of show person, the kind of keynote speaker type person. You don't have to be that person to be a good public speaker. You can just be a good educator if that's the thing that you're good at.
You're an amazing educator, and at an event apart, we invite you to speak every time we do a show, and you've been courteous enough to say yes. And I think that speaks to the quality of you as a speaker and educator. I remember the first time I had to talk. It was a panel at some computer conference that doesn't exist anymore. It was one of the first things for web standards. And I actually hid behind Jeff Veen and George Olson. Like the three of us, and which was easy to do because I was small and they were big. But I hid behind them like a four-year-old standing behind his dad or something. Like, yeah, you tell him, Dad. Like, so I love that. And, you know, there is nobody gives this to you, right? I mean, we all have different levels of privilege and we all have different luck. You know, if you happen to have an education and all that's very important. But regardless of where you are in that, in the privilege and luck and background thing, it's still, you can do nothing with it or you can do something with what you've got. And I think you're really inspiring. And just in terms of, you know, I look at you, I mean, I look at what you do in a given day and it inspires me to do more, which is good. And, you know, but I don't feel guilty. I do watch television. I like my stories and, I don't feel guilty about that, but, I am aware that when I think, well, how could I possibly add this to my plate? It'd be like, well, maybe don't watch that TV show and you could add that to your plate.
I was thinking, when people talk about productivity and say, oh, you know, how do you do so much? And I always feel slightly bad that I'm sort of, the other people are going to be like, oh, you know, I have to work all these hours, whatever. Because the thing is, I'm having fun. Yeah. I am enjoying myself with these things. You know, I'm in a very, very fortunate position that I can choose a lot of what I do. And obviously, I have to do boring things. I have to do the VAT returns for my business. I don't like doing those. And then there are things that I, you know, like anyone, I have to do I don't enjoy. But an awful lot of my day, I get to choose the things that I want to do. And I fill my day with those things. And I'm very busy, yes. But I also am aware how lucky I am that I have the ability to make those choices.
I think one thing that really works for you, and it wouldn't work for everybody, but it's also something that works for me, you basically created your own job, or by juggling a bunch of stuff, you create your own gig. The gig economy is definitely not for everybody, and it's not always fair, and I'm not promoting it mindlessly, but I do think for a certain kind of person, like when I was a kid, I could sit in my room and draw comics for hours, and I didn't think of it as work. And when I was older, I could go into my music studio and do music for hours. And someone said, well, gosh, you've just been working all day. You should take a break. I'd go, for what? I don't get it. And, and now my least favorite time is vacation time. I mean, I could have a wonderful experience with my kid at Disney or something. But basically, like when a friend says, we're going to go to the beach today, I love my friends, and I like the idea that water exists, but like just sitting there and, you know, burning, it just doesn't seem, you know, doesn't seem like fun to me. So I share your sort of enjoyment of making stuff and doing stuff and learning stuff. I think if you're lucky enough to have that as part of your DNA, mm-hmm. it can help you succeed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, everyone needs to find their own way in this. It's why, you know, a lot of productivity advice and things, it's like, well, it works for me. And it, unless you're like me, it's probably not going to work for you. It's about finding and kind of knowing yourself. And that's really important. That's why, you know, I don't really like kind of giving advice. There's a few things I say, like setting deadlines a bit early, or there's little tips that can be useful. But a lot of this stuff is very, very personal to individuals. And it can just seem like you know, I'm expecting everyone should be like me if I give any advice, and I'm certainly not.
I think that's very humane of you. I agree. I mean, I'm probably not ever going to fly a plane. Like, you know, I'd like to write more articles like Rachel Andrew does. I squeeze one out a month and think I'm good. She's, you know, she's doing 2-3 articles a day, it seems. I better fly a plane. That's never going to work for me. I don't even love being in them. Right. My body wants to be on the ground. Just somewhere quiet. How do you still get invitations to speak from people who basically aren't offering to pay you, and aren't, you know, do you still get like, please come to our conference in Lithuania and we'd like you to speak, and the honor of serving us should be your reward or something? Do you get those kinds of invitations, or anymore?
Yeah. I do get them, because I think there is this culture that people will come and do stuff for free, and which is fine if you think, oh, I'd like to go to that conference, and, you know, by going and speaking, you're going to potentially hopefully get your travel paid. But, you know, that's cool. And I do community conferences if I can. But I'm also aware that an awful lot of my time is already given away for free to the web community. I don't get paid to be an invited expert to the CSS Working Group.
Exactly.
You know, so I'm already, I feel like I'm kind of giving back things in the right sort of places, and it comes down to this saying no. You know, it's like, where can I, if I'm going to give a load of my time for free to the web community, where am I best to put it? And I'm probably best to put that in working on specs and in sort of doing the kind of work around the CSS Working Group. So I will do the odd conference that I can. If I'm already somewhere, if I'm already in a location and a meetup says, hey, we have this meetup and would you come and talk? Of course I will. You know, I'm there. I'm going to be sat in my hotel room otherwise. That's fine. you know, and or if it's, there's a few conferences, like things like the CSS Conf, that sort of set of conferences, which are, you know, total community events. You know, no one's getting paid.
Right.
If I can get to one of those, because that's kind of my people. You know, these are the people who just love CSS and want to talk about CSS. And I like to talk about CSS. And if I can get there, I will do. Even as an attendee, if not a speaker, you know, I'll just go and hang out. That's cool. But, you know, I'm doing that less and less just because my time is limited. So I think that people should expect conferences to, at the very least, be covering their travel and their hotels. And I think if someone is putting on a conference and can't do that for people, that really isn't a great sign. I do have to see speaking as being really part of my business at this point, because
job.
It's a job, yeah.
So here's a good example of when it's okay. Like when Jeff Veen and his colleagues started Typekit, and he was promoting the idea of Typekit, if you asked Jeff Veen to come speak for free, I don't mean to put words in Jeff Veen's mouth, but I was thinking of him from earlier, and it's a pretty good example. That's someone who could go speak about Typekit and doesn't expect to be compensated because they're speaking about Typekit, or if if the maker of Slack wants to come speak about Slack and the lessons of making Slack, well, that's fine. That's marketing.
Mm, yeah, I think that's it. And, you know, there are people whose part of their job is to speak. So, yep. For instance, you get people who are developer relations for Google or for other companies or whatever. Well, obviously, you know, they will come and they will speak for free because they're being paid, because they're doing their job. You know, they're being paid a salary to be there. And so that's, if you know, people need people to speak for free, well, those people will do that. That's, you know, and there's some very, very good speakers who are developer relations people. Whereas, you know, me, I'm an independent, and so speaking is part of how I make a living, doing this stuff. And I don't feel bad at all about saying, well, no, you know, actually, I do need to be paid to do my job.
Yep, yep. That was, my silence was a lot of head nodding. I want to ask you two more things. The first is about Apple and Microsoft.
Okay. As in Apple machines and Windows machines.
Yes, you recently had a long, drawn out, fairly public bad experience with a MacBook Pro.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And it seems kind of drastic to switch to Windows, but I think you're in the middle of that. And how's that going?
Pretty well. So essentially, I mean, I've been working. I've never actually really worked on Windows full time. I was a Linux desktop user for a very long time, and then when I started doing all this public speaking, I decided I wanted just to have one computer, because what I was doing is I was working on Linux, and I'd have a Windows machine or a Mac around to run, say, Photoshop or whatever it was that I needed that I couldn't get for Linux. But I was really, you know, my main machine was my Linux machine. And then I started doing all the public speaking. I thought, I just want to have one computer. So the Mac was the obvious choice because it is Unix-based. So it was sort of straightforward to run a lot of the Linux stuff that I run, and I run VMs on the Mac mostly, and Docker these days to do a lot of the stuff that I do. So that was all fine. I had one computer. And then kind of every successive MacBook Pro got worse, kind of leading to this Touch Bar machine, which I've now got, which has just been an utter disaster. The keyboard's broken, the Touch Bar flashes on and off, the thing shuts down, it overheats. I edit text files. It should not be so difficult for this machine to cope.
Did you ever think about switching to Air? A MacBook Air, yeah.
Well, they're not really powerful, because what I do is I run a load of virtual machines all the time.
Got it.
So I need a reasonably powerful machine to do that. And I wanted one machine, you know, a machine that I took around the world with me. I'm on the road for half of the year.
Yep.
I want a powerful machine that can do anything I want to do. If I want to edit a video, I want it to be good enough to edit the video. You know, it's all of that. So anyway, And really what it comes down to is, when I was on Linux, I used to build all my own machines, and I know quite a bit about hardware, and I am fed up with being tied to bad hardware. And at this point, you know, Apple do not have the best hardware out there. And it's that. It's not really a Mac versus Windows thing. It's I don't want to be on this terrible hardware and to be tied to this terrible hardware, because you can't install macOS anywhere else.
Right.
So, and I could go back to Linux, but that is hard work for speaking, and it is hard work for, you know, there's apps you just can't get. Whereas on Windows, I can have, you know, Adobe apps, I can have obviously all the Office apps, which I do use. And I can, because, you know, you can now basically run Linux on Windows, I can still do all of the Linuxy stuff that I do anyway. And so it's kind of a common sense move for me. And it gets me off being tied to one particular type of hardware. You know, I've got a Surface Book at the moment, which I really quite like. It's a very nice device, a lovely screen, really nice keyboard, very happy with it. But if I don't like something about the Surface Book, I've got so much choice when I'm on Windows.
Right.
You know, I can go and look at all the different hardware. I can try it out. I can say, hey, I really like this keyboard. And if I want to have a desktop, I can build myself a machine again. You know, so it's about that. It's about having choice rather than, oh, you know, Mac versus Windows so much. It's really this very enclosed, tied down solution, which includes both the hardware and the software, or being able to say, hey, I'm going to use Windows, and then I can have whatever hardware I like. And I like that idea, really.
That makes sense. And I know you'll keep us posted. And I have one last question for you. It was just International Cat Day. That was yesterday. And you and Drew, your partner, just recently got Pixel.
Pixel the kitten, yes.
Tell us about Pixel.
Well, so we had an older cat for a long time, Widget, who recently we had to have him put down. He was very, very poorly, and we were both desperately sad about this, but particularly Drew, because Widget adored Drew. And we were going to leave it a while before we got another cat, but we were both so sad and missing having a cat around. We ended up adopting this 8-week-old kitten, Pixel, and he is wonderful, but it's like having... I said on Twitter this morning, it's like having a very, very fast toddler who is also armed with small knives. is that he can now run up my leg, which is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
he's great. It is great fun. We're putting lots of pictures of him on the internet because he's very cute. But it's fun having a little kitten around. So yes, that's That's my distraction at the moment from work is chasing this kitten around because he likes to play.
I think you made a lot of people happy when you made that decision.
Yes. Yeah, people are enjoying. Drew likes taking photos, so he's been taking loads of very, very cute kitten pictures and putting them on the web. And
I remember when Widget was sick. It sounded exactly like what Giovanni had gone through, and I was just like, oh, my God, that's going to be bad. I just know. I didn't say it, of course. You don't go, hey, my cat had that, died, by the way, so yours will too. But, you know, but I was like,
yeah, it's very, very tough. But, yeah. So, yes, we still miss Widget very much. And yeah. It's the first time it's really happened to us. You know, I never had family pets as a child, so it's kind of the first time. You know, I'm 43. It's really the first time I've gone through that myself. So, yeah, it was tough, both for, because I miss him, but also seeing how sad Drew was and how sad my daughter was about it, you know. So,
but
yes.
Love hurts. I mean, that's the deal.
Yeah.
You don't get the joy of it without the, you know, the pain that happens when the person or the being is gone. So, many years ahead for Delightful Pixel.
Yes.
As we wrap things up here, Snow White is sitting on my printer looking at me. wondering why I'm talking into, because she can't hear your part of the conversation. So she just sees me talking into a disc and I'm sure thinks I'm insane, which, you know, she's not half wrong. I want to thank you, Rachel Andrew, for today's episode. Your latest book is the new CSS layout. And your latest product is Noticed. We didn't even talk about Noticed. I am so sorry. I'll have to have you back to talk about Noticed.
Yeah, or get Drew on to chat about Noticed, maybe.
That's a good idea.
That would be great, yeah. So, interesting.
Okay, well, thank you, and I will see you on the internet and hopefully soon at another conference.
Yep, I will probably see you very soon.
Okay, take care.
Take care.